Vous écoutez en balado-diffusion le colloque Civic Freedom in an Age of Diversity, James Tully's Public Philosophy, présenté par le groupe de recherche sur les sociétés plurinationales. 20e épisode, conférence de David Owen, The Power of Exemplars.
It's always one of the things about being the last of the hoi polloi, as it were, that one listens to all the other papers. So I've been kind of rewriting my paper as this conference has been going on to sort of try and cut out stuff that other people had already said. And of course, I get to this session and I listen to Demetrius's paper, and I kind of realize that essentially my paper is just a long and possibly slightly boring footnote to his, as will become apparent. So I'm grateful to Joss and I hope still to Demetrius for the invitation to come here. It's wonderful to be here. And I think just before I start, the kind of gathering here itself sort of exemplifies something significant, which is not simply that Jim knows lots of really nice people, also very interesting, and who want to come and honour him. But I think kind of more importantly, I think it also illustrates the point that there isn't and cannot be and should not be a school of Tullyism, as it were, in the way that there can be a school of Habermasians, for example. And that's simply because Jim doesn't give us a theory. Doesn't give us any kind of, you know, theory in that strong sense. Rather, he offers us a practice of doing political philosophy. So there can't be a school, but there can be a community. And I think that, in a sense, Jim's gift to us is that community that has been formed in and through his work and his person. So, I mean, I was very struck by Dale's comment the other day on philosophy as a kind of gift-giving. And I kind of want to say that Jim's work, as it were, is an exemplification of what Dale was referring to there. Now, some philosophers start from theoretical problems, you know, problem of skepticism, problem of whatever. Others start from practices. And I think Jim's work starts from practice and a very simple kind of question. So the question is, what is it to listen? How do we cultivate our ability to listen? What obstructs, undermines, diminishes our capacity to listen? And that's essentially what the paper is going to concern. So I start with an epigraph from Wittgenstein. But being guided is surely a particular experience. The answer to this is you are now thinking of a particular experience of being guided. So in the paper, I want to explore the stakes involved in what I take to be a distinctive feature of the practice of public philosophy, namely theorizing through exemplars, not starting from principles and trying to kind of work up, but focusing on exemplars, taking the struggles of a people as an exemplar, taking a particular person as an exemplar. So I want to look at the ways in which the notion of exemplarity or exemplars plays a role in Jim's thinking and why it does so. Now, I'm going to start by reflecting on an issue that's been raised by nearly everybody, actually, so far, namely Jim's focus on practices. So what kind of guides him to address practices? Now, one thought might be that practices are a source of political invention and imagination. Another might simply be the ethical idea that we should attend to what the people subject to governance think about the governance to which they're subject.
Okay, so kind of we should listen to them.
And I think that's right, but I think that in a way Jim works out a kind of Jim's, if you like, the philosophical basis of Jim's thinking emerges from trying to kind of think, well, what's actually involved in that? What kind of ways do we think about subjects and subjectivity in taking them, people seriously, and listening to what they have to say? So over the course of his work, Jim has come to, I think, adopt an approach to subjectivity, which is broadly common across Nietzsche, Heidegger, Wittgenstein, and Foucault, in which, in Christoph Menke's nice phrase, the praxis of practice is the medium of constitution of subjectivity. Through the praxis of practice, we acquire the abilities that are at once the ability to perform actions that engage the norms or realize the goods of the practice in which we're engaged, and the ability to direct our own activity. Thus, subjectivity is the practical self-relation of self-direction that's located in being able to carry something out. Now, the critical point of this account is, first, rejection of the equivalence of subjectivity and self-consciousness. So it is, if you like, a critique of theoreticism and the claimed primacy of a transparent self-consciousness. Knowing how, in its slogan, is prior to knowing that. It is, second, the rejection of the equivalence of subjectivity and will. So it's a critique of voluntarism and its presumption of free will. I can only will what I've acquired the ability to do. The ability to act, therefore, entails that power comes not only before knowledge, but also before freedom. So the basic self-determination of the subject can be summarized as follows. Subjectivity means power to act, and power to act is twofold, carrying something out and self-direction. Subjectivity consists in this twofold power. It's effective in every activity, it's gained through practices. By acquiring the capacity to carry out a particular activity, we thus also gain a new dimension of self-direction. Practices are the media and expansion of self-references, they are the media of subjectification. Practices are also, of course, the media of socialization. And I think Ty's talk last night was a nice illustration of that point. So we can see the kind of practice term that Jim is engaged in as being kind of worked out through this kind of account of subjectivity. Now this also means, since practices are necessarily embedded in historical time, that subjectivity is historical, and that any attempt to understand the emergence, development, and conditions of transformation of forms of subjectivity requires forms of analysis that are themselves historical. How seriously do we take this point? Now, one option is to try to give an historical account of how it is that the practices of reasoning constitutive of modern subjectivity have a context-transcending validity that allows us to posit standards of historical progress. So a kind of Kantian as-if or a Habermasian quasi-transcendental kind of move. Another option is to argue that the critical movement within practices of reasoning has a kind of holistic coherence that enables us to see it as a teleological process of progress towards a goal that is, as we gradually come to see, imminent to this process. Jim adopts a more modest position. A more modest position which is sees practices of reasoning as contextually engaged modes of reflection bound up in diverse struggles, riven with relationships of power, caught in path dependencies, capable of reflective questioning, but like our motley ensemble of language games, lacking the kind of holistic coherence that would allow us with any confidence consistently to ascribe global significance to local progress. So I think one way to think about why is Jim modest here, why does he go this modest route, is simply to say that the worry, if you like, the concern, is that giving this kind of alternative grand stories, ascribing coherence to our activities globally in this way, is the kind of thing that can get in the way of listening. Get in the way of listening to people's hopes. If we've got our account of modernity and how we get to modernity and what the meaning of modernity is and what the standards for judging whether people are modern are, well then that's going to kind of frame and structure the mode of our relationship to them in a way that can distort our capacity, undermine our capacity to listen to what they have to say. Now suppose that we hold this view, suppose we hold this modest, motley ensemble of people engaged in practices with one another. How does this affect how we engage in political theory? And it's here, I think, that we can turn to the issue of theorising through exemplars. Perhaps the most straightforward way to begin this contrast between theorising through principles and through exemplars is to note two initial points. First, that whereas principles aim to tell us what, as an agent, we ought to do or be, as it were, so you might say to direct us towards another world that's possible, exemplars show us what such doing or being as an agent is. They, if you like, show us that another world is actual. Second, whereas principles articulate norms in their generality, exemplars disclose norms through their individuality. Now, taken together, those two distinctions, what you might call the, as it were, abstract concrete distinction and the generality individuality distinction, direct us to three further points of interest with respect to these distinct ways of seeking to guide judgment. First, exemplars are always necessarily disclosures of a norm in practice, indeed of a norm that is given through performance as practice. Second, an exemplar's disclosure of a norm is always through the individualization of the norm. This is, of course, the point of Kant's remark that exemplars are not for imitating, but for following. Third, the reconstruction of the norm disclosed is always an engagement in historical reflection. So one way of reflecting on this process, for example, is to adopt a model put forward by Brandom. So Brandom suggests that the kind of rationality that is useful in understanding norm, and he's talking about it in the case of concepts here, is to say, well, it consists in retrospectively picking out a trajectory through past applications of a concept so as to determine the norm one can understand as governing the process and so project into the future. And the model he proposes is that of judges in the common law tradition. So common law differs from statutory law in that all there is to settle the boundaries of applicability of the concepts it employs is the record of actually decided cases that can serve as precedents. So whatever content these concepts have, they get from the history of their actual applications. A judge justifies her decision in a particular case by rationalizing it in the light of a reading of that tradition. So by selecting and emphasizing particular prior decisions as precedential, a norm emerges as the implicit lesson. And it's that norm that's then appealed to in deciding the present case and is only implicitly taken, to be binding in future ones. In order to find such a norm, the judge must make the tradition cohere, must exhibit the decisions that have actually been made as having a kind of rational character. So each of the prior decisions selected as precedential emerges as making explicit some aspect of the implicit norm, as revealing a bit of the boundary of the concept, telling a story of this sort, finding a norm by making a tradition, giving it a genealogy, is a form of rationality as history, the kind of mode of doing historical rationality. Now, if one considers how Jim reconstructs the tradition of common constitutionalism or of civic citizenship, it has something of this character, attending to the present case in its individuality by giving it a genealogy and thereby drawing out normative significance from it. But there is obviously a significant difference between Jim's practice and Brandom's model. Because Jim, in reconstructing and taking particular struggles as exemplars, is showing that the reconstruction of the genealogy of constitutionalism or citizenship can be seen in terms of a contrast between two distinct orientations, modern versus common, civil versus civic. The distinction between these orientations is that the former, modern, civil, exhibit what Michael Temolini called the craving for generality. To be, that is the craving to be the rational form of constitutionalism or citizenship. I mean, this is kind of rather like Nietzsche and Bernard Williams' critique of morality, that sort of morality presents itself as if the rational form of ethics, whereas actually ethics is much wider, more motley form of activity. Oops, thank you. So the point of this, the point of the contrast, okay, which is what a careful attention to the struggles and, as it were, build the upper way of understanding it is to do, is not to reject, as it were, the civil rights, civil institutions and features of civil citizenship, but to reject the claim to generality that the civil orientation involves, and thereby free us from the restricted view that that picture holds us captive to. So the claim that Jim is kind of making in these sort of necessarily historical reconstructions that tend to the sort of individuality of each of these struggles is that the claim to generality made by the civic view stops us from seeing what is involved in those struggles. It, as it were, occludes their individuality by subsuming them as a type of struggle. So we have, you know, fools under a general rule as just a member of the set. Okay. Attending to it as an exemplar is a way of trying to take seriously the individuality of each struggle. You know, then you work out your networks of similarities and differences in the process of trying to understand it, but that's the way in which you try and grasp its individuality. So that's the first, if you like, way in which I think theorizing through exemplars enters into Jim's work. But there's a second element, which I will move rapidly to, which is, if you like, you can thematize under the notion of exemplars as ideals. So one way of presenting ideals is, you know, in terms of some kind of norm that we must reach or some principle that must be realized. So there's a particular sort of orientation, you might say, to kind of end state ideals, what Tony Layden has called end state ideals. But of course you don't need to think about ideals in that way as something, as it were, you know, as that we must reach towards or as close as we can get to. We can also see ideals, as Tony points out, as constraints. So ideals are not something we aim at, but, as it were, modes of constraint on our current agency. This is, of course, how Kant thinks about ideals. But here, and I'm going to borrow another distinction from Tony, we need to distinguish between constraints as ideals and ideals as constraints. So one way of thinking about this is to say that there's the Kantian move whereby, you know, you have these very strict, kind of rigorous constraints on conduct. The other move is to see the ideal as more like a sort of ideal set of practices, which in practicing you seek to realize. Okay. Now, I think that kind of Tony, in his discussion of this, seems to sort of get into a sort of little bit of a problem, because it sounds like he's saying, oh, well, there's things you aim at, and there are other things that are sort of constraints on what you do. And now I'm going to say, here are these ideal practices, which are kind of both of those things. And so the initial contrast starts to look unstable. But one way you can make it that stable is to say, well, think about what an exemplar is. An exemplar is a way in which we are shown what the ideals as constraints on conduct are, as it were, revealed as in the other as exemplar. Now, this then kind of raises a final question, which I will end on, which is, well, what's the authority of exemplars? Okay. So we set out an exemplar. Jim will set out Gandhi as an exemplar. What's the authority of that? You know, as a model of way of thinking about ideals. And the authority here is, I think, kind of best captured again by something that Tony's developed much more fully, which is the notion of the authority of connection. What, as it were, gives an exemplar authority is that we give it authority. Okay? So one sort of word that's been kind of used quite a lot in this conference has been the extent to which Jim's work or other people's work resonates with us. So one way of thinking about that sort of relationship to exemplar is the extent to which it attracts us, the extent to which it resonates us, the extent to which it calls for us. Or as Emerson would put it, the extent to which it holds open to us the kind of attainable self to which we move. An exemplar then is a proposal to us, an offer to us, a gift, if you will. But it's also a challenge. Okay? It's a challenge to us to overcome our current self, to, as it were, move from the attained to the attainable self, a process which is unending. Because unlike the movement from, as it were, as standardly construed, the real to the ideal, where we have some ideal that is fixed, and where the notion is that as we move towards it, we get closer and closer to this fixed horizon. Okay? In the movement from the attained to the attainable, as we move, the horizon moves with us, as it were. As we move from one attained position to another, so the attainable moves as well. So, in other words, we have a kind of processual thinking of ideals and, if you like, the demands of normativity on us here, rather than a teleological view. And I think one of the, for me, many exciting features of Jim's work is the extent to which, as it were, teleology is displaced by process in thinking about political theory. Thank you very much.